of things quickly before we begin. We will first ask you to introduce yourself and provide us with opening comments. Council members will then rotate and ask you questions. And then we will try to save 5 to 7 minutes at the end for you to ask us any additional questions that you may have that have arisen from the dialogue today, as well as to provide your closing comments. So any questions at this point?
No questions.
Okay. Well, welcome, and we invite you to begin your opening statement.
Acting Chair Porter, members of the Region's Candidate Advisory Council, thank you for your time today and for shouldering this responsibility for both our university and the state of Minnesota. I look forward to engaging in dialogue this afternoon that will surface important ideas, as well as the more unique aspects of my vision for the University of Minnesota. I'll do my best to be clear and hope you'll feel completely free to seek out any details in addition to what I mentioned. Now, I've applied for the 4th District seat on the Board of Regents for two primary reasons. First of all, because we are facing an era of immense, unprecedented, and potentially punishing change. I've been fortunate to gain significant external industry insight and experience and possess the boldness necessary to face these decisions head-on and serve as a guiding force for the betterment of our university. And the second reason is because I possess a particularly unique mixture of internal University of Minnesota-based experience and insight, which position me to effectively address issues facing the U with a firsthand viewpoint. But before I expand on those two elements of my candidacy, I want to briefly recap regarding my own heritage at the U. I have a uniquely connected family history with the University of Minnesota that originates at my parents' immigration to Minnesota from Bangladesh to attend the U. And it continues with my own birth in the Mayo Building on the East Bank campus. And this heritage branches further with my own attendance of talented youth math programs at the university during middle school while I was in Regina, and later entering undergraduate and graduate programs in neuroscience and epidemiology, respectively. And during the latter course of study, my heritage at the university expanded significantly as I met my wife in the very same Mayo Building where I was born. I later saw the birth of my first child in the U's hospital system and raised my two sons in graduate and partnered student housing just a few yards from where I grew up nearly 30 years before when my parents, siblings, and I lived there. But what I've not mentioned before is also my wife's family heritage with the university as well, where her grandfather was the notable microbiology professor, Fred Schmidt, and where her own family attended various programs between education and natural sciences. So first and foremost, the university for me represents family. Now, as I mentioned initially, we face an era of accelerating change and industry disruption, which is further complicated by seismic shifts in demographics, consumer-centered innovation, legislative mandates for efficiency, and rapid adaptation to new technologies. My current vantage point as a healthcare and life sciences management consultant with the Minneapolis Office of West Monroe Partners allows me to witness and participate in events happening at the vanguard of these changes as they happen. I've guided companies through downstream effects of the Affordable Care Act. I help executives determine whether to buy or sell companies in response to market pressures. And I create robust operational efficiencies in complex organizations striving to perform at higher and higher levels. As you might imagine, these roles continue to provide me particularly current and deep insight into how the market is reacting and adapting to constant changes in direction. As an avid participant in recruitment, this viewpoint also gives me the unique opportunity to interact and recruit with talent from graduating student cohorts at a university level. Thus, as a regent, I would not only be able to offer a viewpoint of what our graduates face in the workforce in terms of industry change and applicable preparedness, but how they measure up against competition from other schools. While this external experience is crucial, the other element of my candidacy which complements my external viewpoint is my internal view of the University of Minnesota. During my undergraduate and graduate studies, I was extremely involved in student leadership and also gained a number of perspectives within the university through roles which included, but are not limited to, teaching assistantships, committee memberships, graduate research assistantships, editorships, and junior scientist positions. Now, the U also facilitated numerous external experiences for me, which included foreign research opportunities under the director of the Nobel Prize Committee in Medicine and Physiology and the World Health Organization. I've lobbied at the Capitol for our budget request as a former president of the Graduate and Professional Student Assembly, and I worked closely with Bob Brunings and Jerry Reinhardt and others on a multiplicity of issues facing 13,000-plus graduate and professional students across all our campuses. From an additional leadership standpoint, I've also had the opportunity to work in collaboration with and lead a variety of minority student-based groups on campus, which include both international and domestic origin minority students. So this internally based viewpoint of the University of Minnesota, I believe, is critical because in order to set a guiding framework for the university, one must be cognizant of how the U operates and what its internal apparatus consists of to be able to actualize its vision. So as a regent, I would be well positioned to speak from significant firsthand experience in this regard, and therefore my governance would be well informed of the reality on the ground faced by students, faculty, staff, and the like. As well, my potential addition to the board would help further reflect the changing face of the communities that we serve. In closing, I actually wish to open the discussion further by stating a little bit more about what I believe we face as a university system. Some of you are very familiar with the Midwestern Higher Education Compact's Higher Ed Redesign Initiative, which was piloted last year. The central questions asked within that framework, which was facilitated by the U School of Design, related to envisioning and actualizing what higher education needs to look like to serve more diverse populations with greater robustness and relevance. Now, if we juxtapose this against the very core of what industry disruption looks like today, as defined by the inventor of the term, the coiner of the term, Clayton Christensen at Harvard Business School, then we begin to understand that to be a relevant and leading institution embodying both our land-grant mandate and our global research eminence, the University of Minnesota may need to go so far as to completely reimagine who it serves, how it serves them, and fundamentally why it does so. And with an achievement gap in our own backyard that more and more resembles an achievement chasm, the U has to face these questions head-on and unabashedly. And I'm confident that I can raise my voice to address these and other challenging questions with a bold and steady resolve. Thank you.
Thank you. Pat, would you like to open?
Yes. The first question Madam Chair and Tiki, the first question I have to ask in light of your very eloquent description of your birth history, do your children bleed maroon or gold?
If you ask my younger one, he'll say he bleeds blue because he follows Chelsea Football Club in London. But I'm trying to change that.
Okay.
I'm trying to change that.
Okay. Could you describe a little bit more about you used the term punishing change, I believe, in your opening comment. And I think you referenced a few things, and I was trying to take notes, and my shorthand is not very accurate sometimes. But shifts in demographics, technology, Affordable Care Act, legislative funding, and operational efficiencies. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but
no.
Those are the notes that I have here.
That's incredible that you captured those.
Well, okay. And I know I missed a few more. Could you just you did a very good job of – and I would like to hear a little bit more about that.
Sure. So I will do my best to answer those directly. If I leave anything out, please remind me. So the reason I referred to it as punishing change, and I did so to get not only to get the reaction, but to make you think about how could we be punished by change in the marketplace. And I did reference at the end Clay Christensen, and if you get an opportunity to read anything or listen to anything by him on YouTube or on HBS, the website for Harvard Business Review at the Harvard Business School, please do, because he discusses this in great detail. And the core of what disruption consists of is it takes an existing service and it recreates it in a way that expands the number of people that can have access to it. It fundamentally changes the marketplace in a way that creates a new customer base by virtue of catering to them. So an example that Clay Christensen talks about, for example, is in the era of large steel mills, there were mini mills that came out and fully upended the business model. It's not that they were doing something fundamentally different. They were doing it for different people. Now, when I think of punishing change, I think of someone like Sal Khan, who shares a Bangladeshi heritage with me. And as we all know his name now, and we wouldn't have known him 2 years ago, but with Khan Academy, he has demonstrated that education and massively online open courses can really change the way we talk about what it means to teach people things. And so the U faces traditionally what Clay Christensen would call the innovator's dilemma, which is to say, what do we do now with this? Who do we serve? Do we increase the price? And if you take a car analogy, say, well, do we make bigger and more expensive and nicer SUVs, or do we change the model of the car that we put out there because more people need to get transport? And I think when I talk about the seismic shifts in demographics, I think about a lot of different things. I think about first time that we have four generations in the workplace. That needs to be reflected in the way that we approach education. I think about urban-rural balances and how important it is to gain from one another. And, of course, the obvious things that we think about in terms of race, ethnicity, gender, all of these elements of diversity, which are coming together in a place that will punish a stagnant institution if it doesn't think about how to deliver on the educational needs that relate to that. Does that sum up a little bit?
I have a better view. Thank you.
Sure.
I have a follow-up to that. Can you give us an example of somebody you've worked with that you actually worked in that area and led in that area, or is this conceptual knowledge from authors and an intellectual pursuit on your part rather than being in the trenches and making it happen?
Sure. Absolutely a valid question, Margaret. And I would say that probably one of the key areas where we face this on a regular basis in healthcare consulting are those who are traditionally payers in a space where they've done insurance in a certain way for a very long period of time. And then you have organizations, even in the Twin Cities, like if you know Abir Sen, he was one of our clients at Bloom Health, and they completely turned the model of what it means to be a broker, what it means to be an insurance provider, all of those things on its head. And that organization further turned into Gravy, which is now doing things just like Oscar in New York, where they are completely changing the nature of how people shop for insurance and how they offer things to the individual marketplace. And so in our work, we help payers, for example, cater to the newly existing individual marketplace and help them create e-commerce options where they can sell individual insurance to you and all of us on a direct basis, which was not a model that they offered their services before. And we enabled them to do that for survival's sake because they otherwise would not have something to compete with the federally facilitated marketplace. So that's a more tangible example of what my work has actually done in the healthcare space.
So is Bloom Health another work employment that's not listed on your...
No, Bloom Health is a client.
A client for Accenture or...
Ask a quick follow-up question, Chair. So you talk about your consulting work. Does that mean that you come and give advice, or have you actually worked through the implementation and been in the trenches of this type of work?
Sure, it's both. So it depends. And if you interact with anyone in management consulting, there's sometimes pure strategy consultants and then sort of operations and implementation types of consulting. And my work has largely been somewhat, I would say, 20% or less on the strategy side of things and more on the doing. So I would say kind of like a 20-80 split. So we kind of, when I have gone in on these types of transformative projects, we are side by side with the client envisioning what they want their future business to look like.
Thank you.
All right, is this follow-up to this one?
Yeah. As long as I'm on the healthcare topic, you mentioned in your application as some of the important issues facing the university related to the evolution of healthcare, as you call it. I'd like you to further describe what that is. What is the evolution, and how is the university involved, and what is the product that they produce?
Sure. So, Councilmember Rogers, what I would say is that there are a couple of different ways that you want to divide that issue when you think about the evolution of healthcare. One is literally, what do hospitals, clinics, and the physicians that serve and providers that serve in those settings, how is their care delivered? And how are their facilities physically designed? So there's a field that's emerging now called service design, which really kind of seeks to ask that question. And I have engaged with builders, for example, in the healthcare community where we're seeking to ask questions and facilitate exactly what should patient flow look like? What should the check-in process look like? What is the empathic sort of ethos of what a futuristic, patient-centered physical facility looks like? So that's a structural element of it. And, of course, there is the educational element of it, of how do you prepare patients for either changing demographics or changing rules, changing methods of compensation. And that kind of leads into the other element of major evolution, which is the advent of the Affordable Care or Accountable Care Organization, which is part of the PPACA. And so the Accountable Care Organization is this sort of this monumental flip which says, okay, in the past, we used to compensate you based on every type of service incident that happened. But now, you have to get sick people well, and they can't get unwell anymore. and we will develop measures for how that's done. And the jury's still out on whether that's the best way to do things. But when I talked about legislative mandates in my statement, this is one of the issues that that is coming to the fore. And when we do, for example, due diligences to help clients determine whether in the healthcare industry they'll purchase one another, one of the reasons that they're consolidating one another and purchasing different types of entities within the healthcare ecosystem is to gain efficiencies that they didn't have when they were separate systems. And so now you have payers buying providers and then creating a system where they can globally control what the efficiency looks like, so the compensation and reimbursement that they get from Medicare and things like that can actually be realized, and that they can come out in some type of a winning, surviving situation. So those, I think, are immense market pressures that a lot of the key players are thinking about. And as a U having a central academic health center and sort of all these allied fields which can feed into healthcare innovation and furtherance of leadership, that's something that I think that the university has to think about.
We're going to move to Lois, and then Kathy, and then Senator Bonoff, and then we have some additional questions after that.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. The phrase, the University of Minnesota is a or the driver of the Minnesota economy. You could put that in the backdrop. And then your comments have done an excellent job of talking about what lies ahead and the disruptive changes you just finished addressing within the healthcare arena. You closed your opening comments by saying the university needs to look at who it serves and how it serves them. So against that opening phrase of University of Minnesota as an economic driver, in the future context, how would you have the who it serves and how it serves them be the greater Minnesota economy?
It's a very good question, and it kind of gets to that heart of the challenge that lies ahead of the mission of the university as a land-grant and research institution, serving the land and its people, as well as being a leader on a global scale. And when I think about what it takes to address that question, I think about who the customer is and where they're getting their information. So I think about, where is the source of innovation coming from? So when I was an undergrad, there was a gentleman, probably at the same time across the country, in Mark Zuckerberg, who decided to hack a solution and come up with something. Now, people may think various things about whether he stole that innovation or what have you. but the truth of the matter, the end point of the matter, is that he created something and he sort of went with it and capitalized on great change in the times. And so I think when we immerse ourselves in communities, we see that people are hungry for education. They're not sure how they're going to afford it. I see people in my own family making stark decisions about, well, I can't afford the U, so I'm going to go to this community college for several years, gain a bunch of credits, and in the process nearly turn 30, and then lose the prime years of my life where I would have been able to go and enact a job. That it pains me to see people do those type of things. And so when I think about who do we serve, how do we serve them, and for what purpose, I think some of the folks at the Higher Redesign Compact, what they were asking is, okay, who wants to learn now? Boomers are aging, but they're not actually becoming, to use a poor term, they're not becoming like invalid or decrepit. They're healthy. They want to learn. They want to contribute back to the system that they benefited from. So does the educational experience end for them? Can a boomer not say, I want to learn JavaScript? What does it mean? Okay. And on the same token, somebody who was not did not have the good fortune of being born into an academic tradition, family or wealth or any of those things, are they condemned to not learning a trade that would be marketable and bring innovative benefit to the state? And so I really worry about what sleeping innovative giants we have in the state that we have not been enabling. And I think the university has to think about what does credentialing mean in this time? I think about 2 or 3 years ago, you posed a question to then-Regent Cohen, who may have been reapplying at the time, and you asked her about, what does it mean? What could happen if a company decides to say, I don't really need the degree, I just want to know if you're a great hacker or not? And that's happening today. That is happening today. And so that's what I think about when I think about who needs to be served and how we need to serve them. So I think it doesn't really answer the question. It actually creates more. But I wanted to give you a viewpoint into how I think we need to start thinking about that. And there are very smart people at the university who are thinking about that. The beauty is, and when Bob Eldie said this really well, he said, we have the answers within the university. We actually do. What we need to do is facilitate that conversation, and whether it's the School of Design that brings all the disparate minds together to create a novel way and approach, or whoever it may be, the voices need to come to the table, and the expertise is there, and the deep sort of quality is there across all the different departments, I feel.
Thank you. Kathy?
Okay, so I'm going to go back to your opening statement as well. And you talked about having significant industry experience. And I'll just hit head on the fact that we look at your application, and it looks like your experience is limited to about 3 or 4 years. And so I'm going to kind of take one of Margaret's questions and ask you, can you give us an example of your industry experience where you're working a project and it failed? And how would you have fixed that? Would you'd want to do it again? I mean, working as a consultant, it's kind of an interesting space to be in for a few years.
So we were working for a client where we had a major failed transaction, and the client was a private strategic billionaire who was looking to purchase a single business unit out of a multi-billion dollar pharmaceutical company. So there was a grandparent company, and they had a child company, as we call it. And within that child company, there was one business unit that they wanted to purchase. And in this billionaire's back pocket, he had 3 revenue cycle management, practice management, healthcare type of software companies. And that one line of business was a set of electronic medical records that served 2 particular subsets of clinician types. And he wanted to mash those up together and sell them later. Perfect example of how people are thinking in the marketplace about what to do and how to gain efficiency in the healthcare space. And we came up against a very difficult situation because the more questions that we asked, the target side were less forthcoming with time. And so what happened is, as you began to peel back the layers, you kind of started to see that maybe there was a wizard behind the curtain who was kind of, not necessarily a person of big stature, but maybe just like, a hamster running on a wheel. And so the closer that we got to that, the deal evaporated. And so our client didn't get what they wanted to get out of that situation. And so in point of fact, that was a particular failure on our part. And I think a lot about what we could have done to win that transaction. And it's a very tough question. But I think it necessitates that you have to look at what are the values of each party in that transaction. And I think we could have done a better job of understanding exactly what they were trying to do with their next move after selling that company and realizing that they didn't want to sell that single business unit. They wanted to sell the whole thing. And it was never going to be good for them to sell just a single business unit. And for us to keep forcing that transaction, even though we made an accurate appraisal of it, it failed. And so in the interest of sort of, some people, I think, with greater experience might have said, Taki, that's just a loss. That's what happens when you make deals. But being younger in my career, maybe less jaded, I do try to think about, how we could improve that. And I probably, given the opportunity to do it again, would have tried to strike a more difficult conversation with the client head on. And I think that's also something that we have to do as potential regents, is be able to face difficult questions head on and say, you know what, maybe we need to hit reverse before we hit drive. And that is a very difficult question when everybody's moving forward. And I think that's why, there's an Israeli concept of the 10th man, where you say if everybody is thinking about the same thing in a room and everybody's nodding their heads, then that last person has to disagree to enable a better outcome for the entire group. To your initial question, Kathy, that is certainly an example of failure. And I do acknowledge that my career resume is in no way going to match the 2 gentlemen from my district that were here before. So we can be frank about that. Because there's no problem about that. I have no shame about that reality. In point of fact, I'm 33, and there's no way that I can match somebody that has that length of record. But what I can do is tell you exactly what I've learned in the space that I've done it in.
and that I think those lessons are very applicable.
Thank you. Senator Bonnell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Collins, there's no apologies for 33. You have great wisdom you shared with us for 33. So I'm going to ask you a real practical question.
Sure.
You've shared about, I'll put it in my words, the need to reinvent ourselves, and couldn't agree with you more. And I like your example of the Khan Academy, because that just kind of illustrates the type of change happening. But then you got to do like the nitty-gritty pass this year's budget, okay? So, the regions this year blessed a budget that will come before the legislature that has a tuition freeze, and that they're asking the state to pay for. So that's an example of this group's approach to the challenge of the cost of rising tuition. Opinion?
So if I just want to clarify that you're asking my opinion on the approach of asking the legislature to shoulder the freeze of tuition.
Mm-hmm.
And this is my first reaction to this question that I have not thought about, but I think that it's not the only answer, certainly. It's an answer that acknowledges the harsh economic realities that we face. We face a world, and if many of you are probably very aware of that infographic that came out from the Times the other day that said prime age working males, it took prime age working males between, I think their 20s, it's like tripled the number of them that are unemployed and not seeking in the last several years. So it's going to be a stunning loss. And I actually was a little upset that they didn't look at, I was very upset actually that they didn't look at females in that, because what's the assumption that only prime age working males are going to contribute to this economy? I mean, Marissa Mayer is like, we're in a Marissa Mayer world, okay? But but that being said, that's half the story. So I think there is an element of that where I would agree and say there are some hard choices where you have to shoulder a little bit of cost to stave off some things, but then you have to start thinking ahead of the curve. You have to jump the curve and say, well, what is it that gives the students much more value for what they're paying for to be prepared for the next era? Okay, do we give an option for every student to learn how to functionally code a website? Because I can go online for free right now, and I can code up Flipboard, or I can code up Twitter by just following a set of tutorials. And who's to say that there isn't a student who has to gravely select after graduating from CLA between one non-career and one idea that they could take into fruition, and how we enabled them to do that. So I don't know. So that's just one small example when I say coding. But what I mean by that example is that we can't keep asking for money that helps freeze tuition, because there are real costs and reasons for that tuition to rise. That are beyond our control. Just like we don't understand fully why the gas is below $2, but we're going to buy it, okay? by God, and maybe you have tanks in your shed, I don't know. we thought about it. But my wife won't know. But there's got to be a way to jump the curve. And so I know when Margaret earlier mentioned, some of these things are in theory. Yes, they are in theory, but there's theory and practice of how do you think about what's going to be the way that even if the pay for what a student has to get this credit for, it's tough on them, but they're going to come out being so much more of a leader in industry in a way that we can show them that they will be making a bigger impact and providing more value and getting more back for their dollar. That's what I think about. I think the jury's out on how exactly we do that, but if we don't think about doing that, then sort of it's kind of rewriting our own sentence.
Thank you. So we'll go to Margaret and then Paul, and then I have a question.
Three of us in the room are consultants. So when we hear you talk about strategic consultants and implementation consultants, we've been there. So I have two questions. You've had three jobs in just a little less than 4 years. Why the changing of the jobs is one question. The second question is, how can you possibly help anybody implement if you are in jobs that are 13, 16 months?
Sure. Sure. So I'll answer a couple of those. But first off, I will back up to say that I think the intent of what you're showing is that I don't have the experience to be a regent. And I get that because I listened to the audio from the last session. And I understand that you have a concern about the lack of experience to be somebody making big decisions.
Well, you're making an assumption that isn't it. So if you want to go ahead and answer the question, I'll...
I'm sorry if it's the wrong assumption. That was what I was assuming that was sort of the thinking. Now, in terms of implementations, as you know, in consulting, there in large consulting firms, like you can take part in different phases of an implementation. And I have taken part in full phases of multiple implementations. So, for example, I'm with an international pharmaceutical company right now that was a divestiture of the biggest pharmaceutical company in the world, and I'm overseeing the phases of implementation of a new ERP solution in all of their Latin American countries, and now I've just inherited project manager leadership of all of their Eastern European, Middle Eastern, and African countries. So I am overseeing multiple work streams, and I have resources in multiple countries. And yes, it doesn't actually span the length of the 5 years that the project is planned, but it's certainly that plan goes on a cycle of a certain number of months that just repeats in different regions because of the scale of the organization. So do I have implementation experience that has seen the breadth of a complete and total implementation? Absolutely not. And absolutely not, because some of these implementations take a number of years. So that's the second question that you answered. Mm-hmm. In terms of the first question that you mentioned about three jobs, this is actually reflective of what we face as young people in this new economy, actually. In order to maximize our potential and to make leaps in ways that will sustain us for future leadership and future economic strength and future innovation, a lot of us have to force our hand to make decisions that allow us to really spread our wings, because we have a workforce that is populated with multiple generations and a lot of expertise, and very, very well-qualified people are changing their roles in order to get more roles. So a perfect example of, you know, if I get very granular about it, why did I make one of my previous switches? Well, I made one of my previous switches because I wanted to do more subject matter in mergers and acquisitions. And the sheer size of greater than a quarter million of the firm that I was at would never have allowed me to do that. And so I could have said to myself, work hard and you may get to do mergers and acquisitions one day. But instead I said, I can't wait for that in this economy. I have to find the opportunity to do that. And again, I apologize for the assumptions that I made at the beginning. I should never have done that. Lesson learned.
Any follow-up? No, because I'll tell you why I ask. I just have a bias on people who change jobs that frequently. Sure. So it could have been you, it could have been the next person, or 10 people down the line.
Sure.
I'll always ask that question.
Okay, that's fair.
Thank you, Paul.
I stand corrected.
Paul?
You've mentioned gaps of... Not everybody knows that stands for the Graduate and Professional Student Assembly at the University of Minnesota. You've also been involved with the Muslim Student Association. Over that six-year period, you had an opportunity to be a leader of an organization. Tell us what lessons you've learned in that experience that bring to mind the difference between governance and management and how it might relate to your service as a regent.
So, Paul, your question is sort of the striking the difference between actually managing and governing. And so GAPSA was probably one of the more instructive experiences in that regard, because you had about 13,000-plus graduate and professional students who were spread across all the campuses of the University of Minnesota. And GAPSA actually at the time was functioning as a 501c3 organization with a $500,000 budget that it requested, and I oversaw the pass-through funds of over $250,000 going to in pass-through grants going to a number of our student councils that were sub-councils of our organization. And one of the biggest things that I kind of realized was that juxtaposition of what's governance and what's management. So we had an office staff, for example. I managed them. But we had component councils of our peers, and and we did not manage them. We governed them. We provided the framework for them to operate as they chose to operate among themselves, based on a set of rules, a constitutional document, bylaws, and essentially all of those moving together to serve the agreed-upon vision of that organization, which is to further the representation of graduate and professional student interests at the University of Minnesota to the administration, to the legislature, and to the community at large. So when I think about the great challenges that we faced there, one of the biggest ones was including Duluth at the time, because Duluth had just sort of formed its student organization over there and wanted to become affiliated with us. And so there was elements of how do we get that affiliation? What do our bylaws say, and what type of fees do they have to pay in order to do that? And then what type of activities and obligations did we have to interact with them? And I think actually one of the biggest challenges at the university is the sheer size, and ensuring that that governance applies uniformly and with equity across all the campuses. And I don't like the term satellite campus at all, because a satellite is just something that orbits, you know, and you can take it or leave it, and, you know, it's out there. One day Pluto's a planet, one day it's not. I don't like that. So those are all, you know, I regard those as sort of all entities that you have to think about applying sort of uniformly to. So I don't see the region's job, of course, is to manage the day-to-day of what President Kaler's responsible for doing, but rather for setting the framework for how his job can be enabled to do the best it can according to a vision that we all agree upon.
Sure. I think we have time for two questions, and I'm going to take the liberty of taking the first one, and then Lois will ask the closing question before we go into your closing statements. In your application, as an employer, you've listed your current employment as West Monroe Partners, and then you have some governance experience with West Monroe Partners Pro Bono Consultancy.
Sure.
Are these two legally separate entities, or can you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah, so they're not two legally separate entities. Our company has a social mission in which we contribute 1% of our time, 1% of our treasure, and 1% of our talent as a company-wide mandate, and it's matched by the company centrally, which is located, the headquarters of the company in Chicago. And the West Monroe Partners office in Minneapolis was initiated in January 1 of 2013, and we have offices, large offices, in Seattle, Chicago, and a lot of other cities. And each of these cities variably have different sort of pro bono footprints. And because of my background and connections in this city, I wanted to take the lead in developing that. So actually right before I came here, I was setting up meetings with nonprofits this Friday where we were exploring pro bono projects to carry out with them. So I'm the lead on that. And in terms of governance, what I am initiating now is kind of a ground-up entrepreneurship where I'm putting in place sort of like the regulations, the framework, the way that we select partnerships in the Twin Cities and all those things, so that from a good governance standpoint, it's actually a repeatable practice that's not subject to who happens to be leading it in the future.
So are there other members of the governance board for the pro bono consultancy now?
So there are, so in Minneapolis, it's at a very entrepreneurial state, so it's myself and another lead in the Twin Cities. But as a national level, there's a number of different levels.
Okay. Thank you very much. Lois?
Thank you. I would like to speak to your age and a follow-on from the discussion with Margaret about your employment. I'm impressed with you. And I'd be willing to underline the word impressed. It is hard to look at the change. It is hard for me, coming from a stability history, to look at the pattern that people your age, slightly older and slightly younger, are following in their employment, because I simply can't relate to it. But I'm fairly confident, and I would like to ask you if you would confirm it, that you are in no way, shape, or form in the minority in the way in which you are approaching your laddering of employment and your durations. And if that is confirmed, how does that reflect on what our land-grant university needs to be going forward?
This is a seminal question, Lois, which it behooves us to examine, and why I think that it's very important to think about what it means to be four generations in the workplace at this time in American history, in modern American history. Because I know brilliant scientific minds who serve coffee. I know many of them. And actually, it kind of I'm affected by that when I think about that, because I think about the academic research that they've participated in. And I'm not denigrating serving coffee, but I don't think we can tell somebody in this day and age that that they can't make the moves that they have to survive and get advanced in what they have to do. And there are various journals ranging from Harvard Business Review to a lot of other organizations that discuss what the millennial plus minus five, or whatever you want to define it as, is facing in terms of determining how to further their professional career. And you're absolutely right that it is very normative to see people at and below my generation making moves that would be unconscionable 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years ago. They seem like heresy, like employment blasphemy, to be doing these things. And I can fully understand how that does not compute when, one comes from an employment where they had a reasonable outcome for them if they stayed the course. And that's not the case anymore. And so so I'm confirming what you're saying, Lois, from my own firsthand experience and from the people in my generation that I've interacted with. And I would say that what the university needs to then think about is, what are those changes that are forcing those people's hands? So I was a neuroscience major, and I was passionate about sodium and potassium channels and opioid receptors. And I don't do anything related to that now, because I was very concerned about the future that I saw in it at the time, with the applications that I was sending out and the responses that I was getting back. And I had a superlative research experience. I had foreign, domestic, top labs on my resume. And I know many other people that had that. And so when I think about, what could the U have done differently, at that time, they couldn't have done anything differently because they didn't know what was coming around the corner. But I think we have enough of a theoretical hold on what has happened in the past 10 and 15 years be able to reasonably say that the change is not decreasing, it's increasing, and the entropy is increasing, and that if we want people to be able to thrive, then we have to make them multipotent, and we have to make them capable of being able to thrive under a variety of circumstances, and that changes the nature of what core skills we equip them with and why we do that. So there are people, and I've said it before, and I'll say it again, there's some people that think that coding is the answer to that. I don't think that that's the only answer. There are many, many answers to that question, but you can't find out what those answers are unless we start asking those very difficult questions. Because the core difficult question that we're asking here is, what is the value of a degree from a higher education institution in this day and age that will enable success and sustained thriving in the marketplace that faces so many challenges? That's what I would say.
So with that, I'll hand it back to you for your closing statement.
Acting Chair Porter, members of the RCAC, thank you so much for your time today. Again, apologizing for my assumptions of Margaret Paulson's line of questions. I want to put that on the record.
I asked the tough questions.
I would put that on the record my contrition on the record. But I will say that what brings us together here is a devotion to the University of Minnesota and what it represents for the state and for the region and for our nation. And I have worked abroad in labs where people knew my school. Had no business knowing where I came from, but they knew it because of the reputation that we have on a global scale. And now we're facing a time where the questions are very uncomfortable to ask about what it means for us to pivot and thrive and not just turn the corner effectively, but jump the bend and put our students and our state ahead. And you are here in a volunteer capacity, and I am here in a volunteer capacity because we are passionate about that. And I want to be crystal clear about that. I want to also say that what I think I could bring to the table is tremendous passion, which I hope you see here today, a unique experience, which I hope I've been able to communicate today, and an avant-garde point of view and a willingness to state it in a public forum, which I think is boldly necessary at the level of the University of Minnesota Board of Regents. And I would love nothing more than my children to bleed maroon and gold and for the value of their degrees and their education to be envied in the marketplace and to be seen as the result of some foresight-filled decisions that were made at a time when a lot of people were scrambling to know what to do. So thank you for your time today and for your consideration and for your volunteership in the service of the state.
Thank you very, very much. Yep.